Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello everybody, and a very warm welcome to a very cold London for this, the first Motorsport Magazine podcast of 2013. And if you're joining us for the first time, thank you very much for giving us the benefit of the doubt. And I know you're going to enjoy it, especially because today we have a rather special guest, a man who is quite literally a part of British motor racing history. Dive into any motor racing history book, look under A for Attwood, and there he will be. Yes, Richard Attwood is with us. Le Mans winner, of course, in 1970 in the fearsome Porsche 917. And more recently, winner of the Glover Trophy Formula One race at the Goodwood Revival. This man just never stops. Quite incredible. And we'll be with Richard in just a moment. First of all, let me tell you, though, about our subscription offer. And this month, we are offering a Greased Lightning Ultimate Valeting Kit. I will repeat that. A Greased Lightning Ultimate Valeting Kit. And that comes with every 12 or 24-month subscription. To take up this offer, simply go to motorsportmagazine.com/GL13 or call us on 0207 349 8472 and quote GL13. I hope you're all still with that one. I'll repeat it at the end anyway. Okay. Since we last were with you, we have won an award. Yes, we have. Incredible. We've won a thing called the New Media Award, which was presented to us by the Guild of Motoring Writers. So we are now an award-winning podcast. Okay. Which is quite apt, really, because Richard Attwood is also an award winner. He won a Guild of Motoring Writers Award way back in 1963. It was called the Grovewood Award. And it was presented to him for being Britain's most promising young driver. How about that? Can you remember that, Richard?
Yes, I do. It was quite an accolade, really. And I suppose it was a start of what's now become the Autosport BRDC or whoever else is involved, McLaren Award. But it was really inaugurated by John Webb, was a man who pushed things along in those days, and it was him, really. And the reception was at the Grosvenor House Hotel in one of the basement areas, because it was quite a small affair. And we had to take the car down as well. And that was an exciting journey just on its own. But anyway, that's another story. yeah, it started there. That really put me on the map, I suppose, in a way. Brought recognition, I suppose, to me, which is great.
Absolutely. I mean, most promising young driver. That's a lot to live up to, isn't it?
Well, maybe I didn't live up to it.
Well, I don't know, actually. I was looking at your career last night and thinking about it driving up to London this morning. I mean, apart from being an incredibly long career and being a survivor, which, you know, is quite something, having raced through the 60s, the breadth of your achievements is interesting. You know, it wasn't just single-seaters or just sports cars. Did you have a sort of a particular goal in mind?
Well, no, not really. I mean, in those days, contracts were fairly sort of liberal. And you couldn't break them, but you could have a Formula One deal maybe, and then you could do sports cars as well, and saloon car races. So, I mean, we took everything we could, really. I mean, you never know when you're going to have a breakthrough in a car that happens to be dominant. So, you know, we accepted virtually anything that was thrown at us, which makes us a little bit not particularly particular, if you like. But it didn't matter. You know, as long as you got into a reasonable car, that was the idea of the game.
I should have mentioned right at the beginning that Nigel Roebuck is with us, of course, as ever, our veteran Grand Prix correspondent, who's on just... I like to call him a veteran. And also Ed Foster, of course, who is the producer of our podcast here at Motorsport Magazine. Before we go around the table, Richard, I just thought I'd mention that I have with me the front cover of next month's Motorsport Magazine, and it features... the Porsche 917, there it is in Gulf colours.
Yes, that's the car that we finished second in 1971, number 19. That's the Gulf car owned by the man who owns all the Gulf stuff, Roald Goethe.
That's right, lucky man. We'll talk to you a bit about the 917 a bit later on. Actually, why don't we do that now? Because I know Nigel likes talking about 917s.
Well, I went up the Goodwood Hill with Richard, and just before you parted with the car.
I don't remember that. Yeah, great. Yeah. But you did. That's great.
Yeah. And yeah, I remember talking to you about it, and you were saying, I don't think you, maybe you did say, in a way, you looked upon the car as your pension, but. That was surely the best investment you ever made, wasn't it?
Well, it was, and I didn't think that it wouldn't be. I thought it would go the way it did, but I didn't expect it to go as well as it did, I suppose, so I was underestimated that. But it was, and it was an investment. I mean, you would think that I did it for the love of the car. I mean, yes, it's lovely to have it, of course, and I did use it. But it worked out better than I thought. But I never paid into a pension fund. I enjoyed the money I had. But when I found that... But I'd done it before with other cars. The first car I bought was a D-Type Jag in 66. So I had already done that. So I thought, maybe that's the way to go. So that's where the 917 came from.
Well, I mean, you bought the car from Brian, didn't you? Brian Redman. Didn't you?
Yes, I did. Remember? I did. How he got to hear about it, I don't know. But it was had been repaired by a German garage called Bernd Bucher, and as soon as I heard he'd bought it, because I didn't know anything about the car, I did say it to Brian, because I'd half-heartedly been looking for one. That if he ever came to sell it, could I have first refusal? And true to his word, he did keep to that, and that's how I acquired it 4 years later.
It's interesting that the 917 sort of donated to your pension fund, when I think the first time you raced one at Le Mans in 69, you hated it. And when it did finally break, you couldn't wait to get out. And
well, I think everyone hated the 69.
Well, I think the story has been recounted before, but it was a very underdeveloped car. But Ferdinand Pieck was the man who made it happen. And at the time, of course, the 908 could win pretty much everything anyway in long tail or short tail form, Spider. So the drivers weren't that keen on trying a brand new car. And it gathered a reputation fairly early on. And the first race it went to was at Spa, of all horrific places, if you like, where Gerhard Mitter and Udo Schutz were down to drive it, and they did, and they qualified, and everything went quite reasonably. I think they were holding the pace back because it was a fearsome beast. But then I only spoke to Udo about this about 4 years ago when I met him at the Solitude Revival. And I asked Udo, because he was lying in his bedroom, hotel bedroom, on Sunday morning, and he could hear the hiss of the tyres going past his bedroom window, and he realised, of course, that meant it was raining, and everything had been done in the dry so far. And but he, fortunately for him, he wasn't down to start the race. Gerhard was, and of course he did half a lap. And the engine mysteriously broke. And I asked Udo if that might have been a deliberate move, and he thought it possibly was.
He didn't run out of fuel on the first lap, did he?
No, that would have been an easy out. So he had to create his own, I think. And it was, so that really, I suppose, I mean, he's a professional driver. I mean, he was used to everything and driven hill climb cars and won championships and everything else in flimsy cars. So he wasn't holding back on bravery. So if he was doing something like that, it was for a very... very good reason.
Well, in fact, Gardner and Piper drove it at the Nürburgring, didn't they?
Well, yes. I mean, the 908 around the Nürburgring would be the car to have anyway. Yeah. And so why would we want to jeopardise our chances of having a chance of winning the race in something that wasn't developed? So there wasn't a driver's strike, but it amounted to probably that. And the factory couldn't persuade any of us to go into the 917. We weren't that brave, I think. And so they got to innocence, I suppose, to come and drive it. And there was a phone call. Well, David recounts the story very well, but he was phoned by Rico Steinemann, I think. And, of course, money was being bandied about because obviously they were going to pay the factory rates or more because no one would drive it as an enticement. And so David, of course, yes. First answer was yes. It didn't matter about the car, yes. And the phone went down, and then 10 minutes later, rang back and said, oh, do you happen to know someone else who could drive with you? And so he got Frank Gardner along, of course, who was in similar vein of thought of money. And they actually did a really good job. But in that race, it wasn't the long tail version. It was a short tail version, which was not the same problem that the long tail was. But of course, it was a much more difficult track. So they earned their money. In fact, I think they had a bonus at the end of the race as well, because they finished. It's the first race they finished. And I think they finished seventh. Dave says seventh.
I'm
not sure
if it was seventh
or ninth, was it?
Yeah. But Frank always said that and the open version of the F3L were the two most terrifying cars he ever drove.
Yes. Well, the open F3L didn't race, did it?
He did. He certainly raced at the BOAC in 69.
Right. I don't know if I was.
But remember, but it had front and back wings on quite sort of tall struts were the thing at the time.
Yes.
And Frank said, you know, the thing is, they weren't working in harmony, those two wings, and. But you know, because the rear one certainly was movable.
Yes.
But he said that after the 917, he thought he would never drive anything like that again, and then and the F3L rolled
all
that back.
Mug enough to drive another one.
But actually, Richard, just what I think of it, something I've never forgotten was the early laps of Le Mans when Stommelen was leading. And as Frank always said, yeah, well, I'm doing his bit for the fatherland.
Yes.
But the overhead camera, I remember, when he was going down Mulsanne, and the car was literally going from one side of the track to the other the whole time. It was weaving that badly, and he was having to bring it back and then correct, literally, its progress all the way down Mulsanne.
Yeah. Well, he would have been driving as fast as it would go, I think. He was that sort of guy, and... you know, he's not around now, but it was quite horrendous. It's difficult to explain to people, and they think that I often think that they don't believe what we're saying because it was that bad. Because aerodynamically, it was literally coming off the ground, and we had a problem with the Dunlop tires in that race, and they started to chunk. Fortunately, so we had to reduce speed by 10 or 15 miles an hour, which actually made it a lot easier, but it was still extremely difficult. It was a totally undeveloped car. And the first time, to tell you how prepared I was, the first time I drove the 917, I never tested it, was to qualify for Le Mans. And I learned about 6 years ago from Vic Elford that he actually nominated me for the car. I could have throttled him. Am I a hero? No, I'm not a hero.
I think just for the benefit of those people listening who are not absolutely sure why we're discussing the Porsche 917, the fact is it's one of the the most talked about racing cars ever, I would suggest, really.
It's one of the great iconic racing cars, isn't
well,
it?
Well, it is.
Full stop.
Of course, and a spectacular looking car, an extremely quick car, and a very, very difficult car to drive at the beginning. But Richard, you won Le Mans. You had mumps, is that right?
I didn't know that. Le Mans is a race of it's very fatiguing for mental as well as physical. And at the end of the race, I was so desperately tired, and I couldn't really work out how bad I was. But there was, of course, it was Porsche's first win, so there had to be a big celebration, and I can't even remember where that was. But I went to the beginning of the reception and the dinner, but I just could not stay awake, and I had to leave. I just was wiped out. And of course, only when I got home to see my doctor, because I was still in a similar state, I learned that I'd had mumps. But the one thing that had affected me during the race is that I couldn't, it happened to me in my throat area, not low down, so I wasn't in any great pain, but I couldn't eat anything. My taste buds, as soon as I went, had anything of any taste, it went straight to my glands here, and I couldn't eat anything. The only thing I could really have was milk. I love cornflakes, but I couldn't have those because there was a good taste of those, salty taste. So I hardly ate anything. So that was another thing that was sort of debilitating and making me very...
And there were only two drivers in those days. That's the other thing.
Well, I always tend to say that the modern drivers are a bit of, you know, they're poofs, really. because they have three or four. But the cars were different. And we didn't have the G-force, of course. So there's a reason for that. And, of course, now the drivers, they drive flat out. I mean, I went with Audi some years ago, and fortunately I have good connections with them because I've done some work with them in the past, and I've been several times. The first time I went, I couldn't get my head around the fact that every session was a Grand Prix for their driver, and they're all competing for their next drive, and the cars are now bulletproof, which of course our cars were not. And the driver's involvement with the car now with a 917 car like that, you had to manage the car. Because if you went flat out, it would break. So that was a big driver input. And John Wire used to tame the drivers, if you like, by giving them a lap time to stick to. And he was pretty strict on that. And he was right, because the cars had to last for 24 hours.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's almost unrecognizable, really, isn't it? The long distance racing of your day and the long distance racing of today. I mean, it's a sprint now.
Oh, it's totally different. The world's different. The cars are different. The massive downforce now. I mean, the 917 would not be a problem at all if we could have worked out underbody or a little flipper or wing or two would have solved most of the problem. Because with the 917 and the long tail, there were two flippers at the back. And they were scientifically very cleverly designed. When you went round a right-hand bend, the right side one would come up to try and hold the back down there, and the left one went level to not give lift because it got enough roll on it. So it had been all thought out with movable wings. And that was the other issue when we got to scrutineering. The ACO said, you're not allowed movable aerodynamic devices. Oh, I don't know what they call them then. And so the factory said, but the car's been designed like that. That's how it's going to work. Well, actually, it didn't work. But it probably wouldn't have made any difference if they'd been fixed, to be honest. The factory, the engineers had designed all these things to perfection. Not. And of course, they thought the car would literally fly off the road, which it was doing. If they weren't made movable, or taken off, I think they would have been made to fix them. But so Porsche management went to all the entrants of Porsche cars, and it's not half the grid, but not far off. And they said, right, well, if you don't allow our car to run, we're going to pull all the Porsches out. They couldn't have done that probably anyway. It was a bluff, and they then were allowed to do that.
Well, I think it's a jolly good thing the ACO got their comeuppance, in my view.
Richard, just while I think about it, just going back to the win in 70, am I misremembering this, or didn't you and Herman opt to run the 4.5 engine rather than the 5-litre?
Well, I don't, because in 69 with the long tail, where it wasn't meant to last more than 6 hours, I think, so Vic says, I didn't know that because he was very involved with the 917 and I was not. And he, you know, we actually went 21 hours. Until the gearbox started cracking, and then the clutch and stopped working, so the gearbox broke, and you know, it wasn't meant to have gone that long. And whether they saw some disappointment in me getting out of the car, it wasn't disappointment at all. I was absolutely delighted to get out of that car. I was drained completely, although the following year I was as well. But it was the stress to drive the car was horrendous. And after my first, we did a double session to start. Vic started, I did a double session. And after that session, I was completely deaf. Yeah. Because the exhaust was under the door. Two of the exhausts were under the door, two out of the back. Amazing. And so I packed my helmet after that but I had a headache for the rest of the race. And there was something else that was wrong. My neck, with the forces of the engine that were so fast, I'd never driven anything so fast as that. I was having to rest my head on the back bulkhead for my neck muscles. That's after the first 2 hours. So you can sell. I would just wanted to leave that car. The factory might have taken that as being disappointment. Absolutely not. but I was rung in about March time, February time in 1970, and I was asked what configuration of car I would like. And so I stipulated that the short tail had been proved by then, so I want a short tail. I want the small engine. I don't want to have the gearbox breaking again. And we want a chance of finishing the race. But by June time of the race, the new engine, the 5-litre, or 4.9, was a stonker. It was fantastic. And so we get to Le Mans with our small engine, and we are way down the grid. And I've just realized after qualifying that we haven't got a chance. And we are literally, I don't know, 13th, 14th or 15th on the grid. So we've got to wait for a dozen cars or more to have a problem before we've got a chance to get ahead. But it was I remember watching the start of that race, and it was like a Grand Prix. Everybody had a chance to win with a 5-litre, whether it was a 5.2 or a 9.7. And that really laid the foundations of the race.
I must say, they were great days. You know, just thinking back, I mean, those cars were so spectacular.
Well, of course, it's all been, it's still on film, isn't it, with the Steve McQueen job. And of course, it was, the story was around the Gulf cars, the John Marr cars, and they were going to win, weren't they? I mean, so why not, let's do a film about it. And of course, none of their cars lasted very long at all. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we should move on.
Okay.
But finally, on the subject of those wonderful Gulf sports cars, next month's Motorsport magazine, keep a lookout for it. They're all on the front cover. It's very beautiful. Okay. Single-seaters, which is what I always associate you with, probably because I used to watch you race at Goodwood when I was a boy. When you were called Dickie Atwood then, weren't you? When did you change your... When did this occur?
Well, I didn't
change, commentators
really.
Always called you. Yeah.
Well, they did.
Dickie,
and I think it was the era that we're modern era, even then probably the modern era, of familiarity, really. Mm. And there are people today still who go to friends of mine and who have been... Motorsport, they followed it, but they don't know me, and they said, "Oh yeah, you mean Dickie Atwood?" I said, my friends said, "Ooh, don't call him that."
Well, I had
so if somebody says that, I mean, I then know they don't know me at all.
No, absolutely, but it is true though, isn't it? I mean, I used to watch you, you know, year after year after year, and you were always called Dickie Atwood. Anyway, now it's Richard Atwood.
But again, those commentators won't have known me.
I remember being at a party once and chatting to a bloke who reckoned he knew this British racing driver extremely well. Jimmy Hunt, he called him all evening.
Jimmy Hunt.
Did you ever, ever hear anybody else ever call James other than James?
No. Okay.
Sorry, anyway.
No, we did not.
So just a little similar Philip there was that with Jim Clark, to me, Jim Clark was Jim Clark, but his close personal friends, it was Jimmy Clark. But I see all the scribes, a lot of the scribes there, they call Jimmy Clark all the time. It's actually quite annoying. And he was annoyed by people who didn't know him well, and they called him Jimmy.
I think in part that comes, Richard, from, I mean, for instance, one of Jimmy's closest, I've said, he just said it then, was Jabby Cronbach. Yeah. And Jabby always said Jimmy. So it's sort of gone into my head.
That's how it gets picked up,
very
isn't
much.
It?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's the price of fame.
Okay.
I am not Bob either, by the way. Okay, but let's just think. Cause your first year in Formula Junior, you came second in Monte Carlo. And then in 63, you won it. I mean, apart from the fact that you obviously had a huge amount of talent, was it a circuit that suited you particularly because you had to be so precise and so neat? And
It seems that way. I didn't really know that until I was on a circuit like that. But in fact, in 62, I probably finished second in the heat. I wasn't in the final because my engine, the car broke. But I just like that sort of circuit, I suppose, and we adapt to what we our nature, I suppose, and I like the proximity of precision. Yes, I did. The chicane of Good was another one, you know, where they, you know, in period they were brick, they were solid, but to save a little bit there, it just might be. You know, a second, not a second, fractions of a second to go towards that. But, I mean, I've gone quicker on other circuits, so I don't know. But Monte Carlo, probably, yes, I have an affinity with, but it happened that I got drives there where I didn't get drives anywhere else because people sort of sort exactly the same as you. So, and in 69 when I drove for Lotus, Colin Chapman, because Jochen Rinter got injured with his stupid wings falling off, and you know, he thought exactly the same. So
it's interesting you say that. I mean, with these circuits that needed such precision, I mean, Le Mans was so totally different. Did you like Le Mans as a circuit, or was it just more the event that was the big?
Actually, Le Mans I found a fantastic circuit. They had huge corners, and you know, White House, or the corners, that some of them are not there, but some of them still are there. And, you know, the Dunlop Bridge was another great corner that could be taken flat. But, of course, you know, coming out of White House, if you're a little bit faster coming out of there because you took that well, then Dunlop Curve ended up being a little bit faster, you know, and he had to use all the road to do it flat. And the 1 year Paul Frere was timing cars from, I think, before White House. Anyway, he was on somewhere quite high up and he could see, and he timed every car from the beginning of White House, I think, right down to the S's or where they disappeared. And the car, it was a test day, and it was in the Ford, the coupe Ford, GT40, and our car was the fastest car. So yes, I mean, I love Le Mans. What was the other corner? There was
Indianapolis always strikes me as being a pretty fantastic.
Well, you're slowing down for that quite a lot, aren't you?
You are, but the approach is.
The approach was a little bit on the curve because the cars were quite loose, and so you take that curve before you get there. Is that first part of Indianapolis? I wouldn't know. But there's that kink there, the right kink, which is, can't remember if that was flat. It probably wasn't, so you're still trying to sort out that, get that speed down as you're approaching Indianapolis. And that was another huge skill factor, came in to get it as fast as possible, brake as late as possible, or gently braking and then firmly braking. It was a great track. Le Mans was,
and
not,
changing
not
down at the same time, of course.
Yeah, but that's all part of the game, isn't it?
It wasn't just flicking a paddle, though, was it? You know.
Ah, well, yeah. You're talking my favour again.
It's interesting, though. I mean, it could hardly be more unlike Monte Carlo. I mean, two circuits, you've just said that you love both of them, and yet they could hardly be more different.
Yeah, my ultimately all-time favourite in period was the circuit at Clermont-Ferrand, built around a mountain, and the number of corners and curves, and I made a couple of good, fast laps. And, that was problem. It combined everything, a bit of Nürburgring, a bit of every circuit you can think of, there was a combination of corner in that circuit. It was fabulous. It really was.
I've heard quite a few people say they actually preferred Clermont to the ring, in many ways.
Yes, I think it was probably a forgotten circuit in a way. They did have Grand Prix there, but unfortunately I missed the Grand Prix. I should have done there, but...
Actually, just going back to Monaco, the first two races, the first two Grand Prix that I ever went to at Monaco was 68 and 69.
Oh, well, you went to a good year then.
Well, but I mean, you were how far? A couple of seconds behind Graham in 68?
I was, but when I drove in 69, the Lotus 49, I realised I'd been completely wasting my time because the Lotus 49 was so much, well, the DFE. Was a proper race engine. Four valves was an up and go, light, powerful, torquey as well. Torque was good, although they say it wasn't, but it was, if you kept it up there, it was fine. And of course, the V12 BRM was a two valve and a sports car engine, not meant to be a Formula One because the H16 had failed. So they were behind. And they put that engine in just to sort of keep the whole thing going. So
sounded lovely.
Yeah. I mean, a V12 is fantastic. But I didn't realise how difficult it was until I drove the following year. Then straight away, so I got like that. It's rather like driving a thoroughbred horse or an ordinary horse. You know, one was purpose built.
Richard, do you put down your involvement with BRM, which is possibly the best known part of your single seater career, I would suggest? Would you say yes with the BRM days? Or
Formula One.
Do you feel that actually, with hindsight, held you back because there was the Louis Stanley factor, there was the cut.
Well, funny enough, when I landed at Monte Carlo for the 68 race, the first person I saw, I think I saw him at the airport, was Louis Stanley. And he said, why are you here? I said, well, I think I'm driving one of your cars. And he obviously objected to this because he obviously thought I wasn't good enough. So he actually changed the entries, and they changed so I wasn't entered ultimately under a factory entry. I was under the Reg Parnell racing entry, and the race car number was not a low number, it was number 15. And he'd bothered to change all that because he thought the BRM were going to be misrepresented.
Richard, if Big Lou was sort of ignorant of the fact you were driving for
him,
absolutely. But who had hired you? Was it Tony Rudd?
Well, of course, Mike Spence had been killed in Indianapolis qualifying, which was probably, I don't know when that must have been, very close, wasn't it?
Well, it was the 7th of May. It was exactly a month after Clark's death.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So it must have been, yeah. No,
2 weeks before
Monaco.
Oh, I see. It was that far. Well, I think it took BRM a long time to find out who they should have driving their car. And Raymond Mays was very pro me, and I'd, because I'd been first contracted to them in.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
64, but I hadn't done very much for them, so it was a bit of a waste of time. But I'd always been on the books type of thing. And they said, well, why, you know, he pushed for me to have another chance. And so that's how it happened, but it must have been towards the end. And how much Tony Rudd was involved, I don't really know. I wouldn't know how that came about. But anyway, I was parachuted in on the, I think I've heard about it, on the either the Monday or the Tuesday, and I landed on the Wednesday, I think, for the race. And I hadn't sat in the car or anything, so had to start from square one. And I worked with Alan Challis and Dobbin, who was a great guy, and we sorted the car out exactly how I wanted it. And I wanted it very soft and roll and low tire pressures, probably lower than ever been run before. And but that was the way the car wanted to be, I thought. And it worked out okay. But Graham was very upset after the end of that race, because he wanted pole and the win and the varsity lap, and he was absolutely savage with me. I could tell the irate. He was really irate within himself, because he would only have to push a little bit more to get the lap record, but he didn't. He thought he'd done enough.
But it was an extraordinary race. I mean, I think, as far as I remember, by sort of 30 laps, there were five cars left.
Yeah, yes, and three of them not in great running order. Well,
Denny Holm, I remember, he had a endless pit stop, and they didn't change the engine, but it was pretty fundamental. And ordinarily they would just have retired the car, but thought, if you finish, you're going to get points.
Exactly, yeah. And that thought still goes on today, doesn't it? Well, it has done in recent times, but yes, it was again a race of attrition, which I seem to end up getting results by, I suppose. But I remember on the first lap, I think, I don't know if Jackie Oliver was out on the first. I did something on the first corner, I think, and then coming through the tunnel, Bruce McLaren lost it coming exit of the tunnel, and he was just in front of me, and I didn't know which way to go. And the race could have ended there as well for me. Just happened to guess the right way, and as he was hitting the barrier there, I went through that way. Surtees had a half shaft go or something like that, and then Pedro was trying to keep up.
Pedro hit the wall in front of me, actually. I was watching a station hairpin.
Mirabeau.
Yeah, did he ever?
Mirabeau, wasn't it?
It was coming out of Mirabeau, coming down to the hairpin.
Yeah. And Rint also had a biff, didn't he? I don't know why, but it did. But I tell you the one thing that they always used to do before the race at Monte Carlo, the just before the race, or in the morning, I think, they used to sweep the circuit, and that created more dust than it would have done if they hadn't done it. And that's what caught Bruce out.
Really?
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
It's interesting.
It was just the grip wasn't there.
How did you get on with Pedro?
Oh, Pedro. I get on with, I think, most people, and Pedro was... He's quite an introvert, quiet guy, but he was great fun. We had a lot of fun. I got on really well with him. He was his stamina, his constitution was enormous, and he became. If you think about Pedro's career, it was a long one, and for a lot of the early years, he didn't do a great success, I don't think. But when he joined the Porsche team, and maybe a little bit before, he was starting to drive really, really fantastically. And in the end, he was the best Porsche driver.
He was one of the... He just seemed to me to get better and better and better. Mm. And as you say, I think he was very much in the shadow of his brother when Ricardo was alive. Because Ricardo was the sort of the great natural talent, and Pedro at that stage, I think, was fairly unsure whether he wanted to be a full-time driver anyway. But boy, you know, once he was into it, he really was as committed as anybody you'd ever see, wasn't he?
Just so everybody's absolutely clear, we're talking about Pedro Rodriguez. And no, that's okay. No, I just think we have to make these things clear. Richard, do you, at the while all this was going on, it was highly, highly dangerous. We've already mentioned a couple of people who lost their lives. Were you ever tempted to call it a day?
Well, you know, when you're in a certain era, these things become an acceptable part of the way of life that you're doing. And it was always there. And there were certain circuits that I used to put my hands together and look up a little bit. And when I left there, and that one was Spa, and the other was the Nürburgring. Because we were aware of the danger, of course we were. I mean, if you made a mistake and went off road, there was no safety at all. It was either a bank or a ditch or a tree or a bridge or a house or a telegraph pole, which I managed to hit at Spa as well. And I mean, I could easily have been another statistic. We weren't brave. I don't think we were brave. I don't think we were foolhardy. It's just that, maybe it was a little bit brave, I don't know, to go through, you know, 160-mile-an-hour corner, you know, within a very fine margin. Yeah.
It shows a slight lack of imagination.
It's the kink. It's the master kink, yeah. Richard. Every time I go to Spa, every year I drive around the old circuit, and every year I just think, whatever was it like approaching the kink downhill?
Yeah. It was part of the job. It was something, fortunately, you had time to get up to speed to. But then, you know, you'd get qualifying and everything absolutely perfect. And then race morning, raining. So all that goes out the window. So you got to start again. And, you know, it's your experience is a great thing. And the more you got, the more sensible you became, probably.
Talking about the Nürburgring there, when you started racing Fords, didn't you race a Cobra at the Nürburgring at some point? Because that must have been a serious handful.
Yes, it was. The Cobra was the first. Was the second race I did at the Nürburgring. I'd been with David Hobbs's Mechamatic Elite the first year, but normally the car was extremely reliable. The gearbox was really good, but in fact it broke, and I don't know if I actually raced. I think I qualified, so I'd learnt the track a little bit, but I didn't really know it. And the second year was with the Cobra, and I through the Lola GT program, I was taken and brought through onto the GT40 program. And so I was, I suppose, a continuation, if you like. And of course, it was through Lola, Eric Brawley, I'm sure. So I was part of that team. But so, and the GT40s weren't, actually, I think one of the cars did go, didn't it? But I think they only had one car there. But because I was contracted to Ford, I think, they said, well, we'll stick you in a Cobra type of thing. And there were three cars entered by Carroll Shelby in the light blue colours, so proper Shelby Cobras. And after the first qualifying, one of the cars had a major accident. I mean, like it was, well, I don't know if the driver must have been injured, I would have thought, but I thought actually he died, but apparently he didn't. And then the second qualifying, there were two qualifying, another car went off flying. I mean, massive accident again. And just before the race, Carroll Shelby came to me, because I was driving with Joe Slessor, and he said, he came up to me and he said, please just finish the race. He'd had enough, you know, and he probably wanted to pull the car, actually. But we did, and we won the class, which is really what he wanted. And Joe and I think we drove it as well as we could with what we'd got. And I'm talking about the old Nürburgring now, not the sanitised one we've got now. And I remember the car taking off 30 times a lap. I mean, it was a bucking Bronco. It was horrendous. And a baptism of fire, really, for my... Well, it was my second race there, but it was extremely difficult. And I thought we'd finished 20-something, but I was with Ian Titchmarsh the other day. He told me we came sixth. I had no idea we'd finished sixth. I don't know.
You shared quite a lot with Joe Schlesser, didn't you? What was he like, Joe? I mean,
Joe was a lovely guy, and French, and I could speak French because I was at school in Switzerland for a while. But I was, I really, because most of the racing in, certainly when we got to Formula 2 and Formula 1 and sports cars were in France, because they had all the great circuits. Like Rouen was another fantastic track, hugely dangerous, but what a challenge. Down that hill there was just, you know, Fangio. You could just picture it, can't you? And all the cars were on the move there. You know, if you're going reasonably, the car's going. And, you know, so I, and there was one period in, must have been maybe 64, 65. I lived in France for about 3 months because there was no point going home because the next race was down the road sort of thing. And with Reims, you know, Reims seemed a very simple, straightforward triangle. But there were a couple of bits there which were really, there was one corner after the, not the one after the pits, the one after that, which was a rising turn where the car goes a little bit light and it wasn't flat, in a junior or a Formula 2 car. So there was a great challenge there, and there was one going down to the far hairpin where there's another curve up to that, the left-hand curve.
Actually, Richard, can I stop you there 1 second? Because something that's always fascinated me about Reims was that the 12-hour sports car race started at midnight.
I think it was 11 o'clock.
Oh, well, yes, sure, I'm sure you're right. But I just thought it was
you met your match night.
It was absolutely. It was quick as hell, that circuit. And I just thought the idea of starting, running across the road, leaping in the car, and starting at night. And particularly, if, you know, if, I know it was normally decent weather, but...
Yes, I don't...
Surely that must have been the first few minutes of that race, in terms of sort of settling in and everything, must surely have been unusually difficult.
But you've got to get on with it, you know? I mean, that's your job, and you know you're going to do it. It's rather like if you're going on a long journey and you've got to do 480 miles in a day, but not on straight roads. And somehow you just get through it and you do it, don't you? And so it's a mental preparation, I suppose. And I drove David's LM there with him, the 1 year with Lucien Bianchi, and I was started the race, and we were first off, but we didn't come past the pits first because all the cars had gone by us by then. But you know, it was, everything was a challenge, you know, to a driver. And so, you know, the first thing, you've got to start first, you've got to get out, and so we did. And it just happened that the engine fired just at the right moment, and that second the clutch was coming up and boom, you've gone, you know, the door slammed shut anyway. And I'm not sure, yes, I think the GT40 was before that, wasn't it, in 64. And the cars looked immaculate. They were beautifully prepared, but they had the Indy engine, which was 4.2, which was it didn't take torque reversals very kindly. And I think the cars broke for other reasons too. But just the signalling pits were where the pits are, and our signalling pit was sort of towards that right-hand curve, which was, I'm sure it was flat in GT40. And every time I got a signal from the pits, I acknowledge it with a little donk on the indicator, the right-hand indicator. And Jim Clark was watching the race. He wasn't in it. And he said, quite funny, actually. He said, how can you manage to do that? And this is from Jim Clark, you know, can do anything. And I said, well, it's just easy. And of course, the controls were perfectly to hand. And I just said, well, it's just, you know, the lads are in the pits, they've got a lousy job, you know, they've got to be there for 12 hours, so give them some acknowledgement. But he was quite impressed with that. Yeah. So I don't think anybody else did it.
Actually, can I just ask you quickly, because what was the reaction from in your family background to you making a living as a racing driver in often very dangerous situations? I mean, first of all, did you make a living out of it? You did, didn't you?
Not to start with. If I hadn't had a father who owned garages, and so the first cars came out of the garage, which effectively didn't cost him anything, to be honest. It subsequently might have done, but in those days you could put things against publicity or whatever. So actually it didn't cost him. So without that sort of background, I probably wouldn't have done anything at all. And he was actually keener for me to do it than I was, and he was more pushy than I was, a bit like sort of modern fathers with their car things. But he didn't actually come to the races, but he provided me with the wherewithal to do whatever I was going to do. And I started with a little standard 10, I did one or two races and that's all. And then in my first real year was 1960 with the TR3A, which was basically a brand new car, nothing done to it other than TR3A. And but I couldn't match the people who got fiberglass panels and camshafts and Weber carburetors and all that sort of thing.
Same old story, isn't it?
Yes. And so that the end of that year, just to give you an idea, I said to my father, I want to start doing what these other guys are doing, because my average finishing spot was about fourth. And I couldn't have won, although I won a handicap, not a handicap, I did win a handicap race, but I won a scratch race at Alton because it was in the wet. But I couldn't really win sensibly. So I wanted to modify the car to go back next year. And he said, you don't want to bother with that. He said, we'll get you one of these Formula Juniors. Well, I didn't even know, I had no idea what a Formula Junior was. That's how backward I was in going forwards. I mean, so he was the push. And that started my 3 years in juniors, at the end of which, then, yes, I started to be attracted to other people through the Greywood Award and BRM. So from then on, 64 was professional.
One of the problems with having someone like Richard Atwood on this podcast is there's so much to talk about that we've been jumping all over the place, but I don't see how to avoid that, because I think that after 45 minutes, we've probably covered a tenth of the man's career, which is a bit worrying, really.
But it's only 10 years.
Well, yeah, I know, but maybe you should read the book, but you did do an awful lot. But we've got some readers' questions to ask you, Richard, in just a moment, but we must ask you about the Goodwood Revival, because here you are, aged whatever, winning races at Goodwood in that wonderful BRM. I mean, why do you do it? Why do you keep doing this?
Well, it's I suppose I always thought that if you have a talent, you might as well use it. And I didn't know I'd got any talent at all. I mean, at school, I was pretty hopeless at pretty much everything because I didn't enjoy it. And I went to five schools, which didn't help. When you do discover something, then you might as well take advantage of that. And I think that's the same with anybody. If you've got a bent for talent, whether it's painting or any sport or whatever else, yeah, it should be encouraged. That's how it started, and that's how it went on. But the reason I stopped was because it was the end of the 5-litre sports car formula, and I thought it was going to be more difficult to get a drive for the following year. I had decided already that I was going to retire anyway because I'd just got married and I wanted to have kids. So I thought in a responsible way. There are a lot of other reasons, and I also promised my father that I would go back and help him run the business. So there are many reasons why I did retire. But why did I carry on? I didn't do anything for about 10 years when I joined the business. I concentrated on that. I really immersed myself in it. I really enjoyed it, actually. It was a different discipline altogether, of course. And then a friend of mine, Michael Ostromoff, bought a 330p Ferrari, and he didn't have a driver for it. He said, "Would you drive?" And I said, "Blimey, what do I want to drive that for?" And really, it started from there. And I sort of got back in a car and hadn't been there for 10 years and found I quite enjoyed it again. But I've done stuff from there on in, really. But the BRM is now not allowed at Goodwood because it's still a Tasman spec, and it's £100,000 to change the engine, and he and I won't do that. So it's for sale, basically, and someone will have to put buy an engine for it.
It's a shame because
it's the end of an era, so that's the end of that.
Well, I just think I could stand there all day watching you go around in that. It's such a lovely car, and there we are. Okay, some readers' questions now. The first one comes from Russell Brewis. And Russell says, the Porsche 917, we're back to that, received a lot of development during its career. Do you think, Richard, that the Ford P68 would have had the potential to be a great car given as much development?
Yes, I drove it in period. And every race that car was entered for, it either was on pole, it led the race, or it made fastest race lap. So the potential was there. And it was underdeveloped, but it didn't need a lot doing to it. at the time, Sid Taylor with Denny Holm with the Lola 270 was the benchmark, really. And I did one of the races I did in 68 was at Alton Park, and we were easily on pole by a second, and the car lasted only 10 laps, at the end of which we were 10 seconds in the lead. So it was not difficult. So the potential and the performance of that car was fantastic. Again, DFV made a massive difference because it was light and it was in the right place and it just had the right characteristics for a race car. So, and it was the first car, of course, to have a sports car to have that engine in it. So it had huge advantages over other sports cars because of the engine package. And the gearbox was very light too. But going further on, I used to drive the 917 with David Piper's races in the 80s. And the F3L was quicker than the 917 around Silverstone Grand Prix track in the late 80s. It was just a smaller package and a more manageable car, I think. Aerodynamically, it was nothing like as bad as the 917 in its initial stages. But, I mean, Frank Gardner's not the bravest of fellows. He's not. He wasn't. And at Spa, he drove the F3L there. And, he was on pole by 4 or 5 seconds or something like that. And we're talking about the next guy on the grid was Jackie X. Now, you won't, a Belgian at his home track in a GT40. So that gives you another fantastic idea, the performance of that car.
Actually, I'm interested in that, actually, Richard, because at the time, I mean, there I was just a fan going to races, but I remember there was a lot of writing in Autosport and so on, as if the car had a sort of slightly spooky reputation. And I think possibly that was, after Owen's accident at the ring. But the way you talk about it is interesting because you make it sound relatively benign.
Oh, I liked the car. I liked any car that gave an advantage, and that one certainly did. And wherever we drove it, it was right up there. And but at the first race it did, I think, was Brands Hatch. And Alan Mann was trying to get Jim Clark and Graham to drive it, I think, and he talked to Colin Chapman about it, and Colin said, "Oh, yeah, maybe, or whatever." Anyway, apparently Colin was never going to allow that to happen, and so at the last minute they were scratching around, but for named drivers, not me, and they got Bruce McLaren, I think, and Mike Spence, and there was another car with Brabham, was it? I can't remember. The other car. Danny Helm was one.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
The car was good. It was quick. And that was racing driver, was a quick car. And that was a quick car.
It was a gorgeous looking thing, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, probably
it really
the best
was.
Looking car yeah. ever, a lot of people say. Yeah. But, yeah. And you look at the sills, it was all sort of shaped. It was beautiful. Yeah. Len Bailey design.
Going to have to rush us along a bit. No, it's okay. We have to rush along a bit because we're up to an hour, which is sort of our allotted time, but well, that's fine. This question comes from Pascal Eakes, famous name, who says that he saw you drive in the Targa Florio in 69, and he wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Targa Florio was a very special race. It was the track, the circuit was 44 or 45 miles round. As the Targa was mentioned at Porsche at the start of the year, and I said, but to Porsche, I've never done a Targa. I said, maybe you should find a driver who knows the Targa, be more sensible to that. And I was told, and I can't remember who it was a German, he said, "Herr Atwood, you will learn the Targa Florio." So I thought, okay, I'm going to be doing it then. And we were sent down there, Brian, myself, Brian had never done it either, and we were sent down in a couple of 911Rs, which are a very rare car. It'd be great to have one of those. There are only 12 made. And so we drove from Stuttgart all the way down to Naples, across to Palermo. So we had 10 days to learn the circuit. That included getting there and back. So the first day, we're getting there. And these cars are very short geared because they're race cars. And we could do only about 105 miles an hour on the motorway, auto routes, autostradas. And I just could imagine so many people must have gone past our car. Yes, and they're thinking, why isn't that why doesn't he change into another gear? Well, there wasn't another gear. But to actually learn the track was our first task in February. And we ultimately learned it. That's another story which I won't go into now, but if you
maybe
want to
hear another
about
time.
It, another time. And we learned it. And we, hand on heart, before the race, we knew every corner. We did. 900
over 45 miles.
Unbelievable. I didn't believe it myself, but we did. And then we go for the race, and we have a Muletto, the 908, which everybody can drive to practice. And the first thing I discover is that my brain has learnt the circuit at a certain rate, and that rate is in the 911R. But with the 908, as you get in the corner so much faster, my knowledge is not coming out fast enough. And there was a series of a left, right, and another left, right, all together. And the last one goes on to a bit of a straight. So the last one, you've got to get faster than the other ones to come out of the corner. And I mistook this for the middle one. And, of course, we've got another left, right to go. And I, last second, realize it. And, well, it was very, very close to me going completely off the road, and my heart went boom, 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 for a long, long time after that, and I calmed down. But that was an interesting factor. But the Targa, I really enjoyed the Targa. It was a race that not many people got injured there because it was so slow. But on the seafront coming back from Campo Felice, it's flat out, you know. And some of those corners are really fast and uncertain. But so there was a danger to that on the straight bit, really. But the rest of it, I loved it. I loved it because, of course, short corners and precision again. And the surface was so polished because the roads had not been redone for years. So it was like driving on, more than a wet road a lot of the time, polished stone. It was fantastic. I loved it. You know, the cars were sliding from one corner to the other.
Great. Okay, well, I wish I'd seen it. I never went to the Targa Florio. Time for one more question, I think. It comes from Mario Carneiro Neto. It's a name to conjure with, isn't it? Richard, your favourite race? Briefly, do you have one? If not, we'll move on.
Well, I thought I'd drive some quite good races, and but some of them, a lot of them, I didn't have a result.
Yeah.
And so, which is very sad, really, in a way. But I suppose everybody will remember the Monte Carlo one. And I would have thought that I'd done as much as I could with what I'd got. And I was a bit disappointed, I suppose, when I drove the Lotus 49 the next year to find that actually it wasn't really good enough. I don't know if I've got a favourite race. I really there was one race at Rouen, actually, which was a circuit I loved because of that downhill section, all the other bits as well, coming back up the valley. And it was a Formula 2 race. I think it was a Formula 2 race. It was. And just before the race, on the grid, my mechanic, Harry Curzon, came up to MRP Lola. And he came up to me and he said, just going to start the race, you know, just going off the grid. He says, I've put a nice new set of plugs in for you. And I won't repeat in the microphone what I was screaming to myself in my helmet. You absolute, because you never changed anything from the end of qualifying to the race. Still the same today, I'm sure it should be the same. And one of them, of course, was faulty. So we had to make a stop, change all the plugs. I think I still finished second, but it was a race that would have been easy to win.
I think it's got to be said, hasn't it, that the history book should be saying that you won a hell of a lot more races than you did. I mean, it's pretty obvious to say that, but you've obviously got that squared away in your mind, I guess, now, looking back on it all?
Well,
or not?
There were things maybe should have changed, but I always reckoned that if I was basically on my own. My father wasn't there in the early days, and I was always on my own. I didn't have a manager. I did it all myself. And to have had a manager who was good could have made a big difference to me. But the two managers I thought out of the top of my head that I would have desired or had as a very desirable asset, one would have been to be taken under the wing of either Colin Chapman or Ken Tyrrell.
Mm.
And I just never had that advantage.
That's interesting.
But you look back at the Formula Junior grid of 1963 all through that year, and amongst them you've got world champions, you've got British touring car champions, you've got sport car champions, you've got all the guys who went on to great futures from junior, and it was a fantastic formula, and it's still a fantastic formula. If only they will stop trying to get more out of the engines, because that's just going to put the cost up.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Juniors is still a fabulous package.
Great. Well, I hope you all enjoyed that. I did. And I know Nigel did, and it looks to me like Ed did as well. Ed's thinking, when was 1960?
he's a young man.
Yeah, he's a young man.
Thanks, Rob.
That's all right. No, it's all good. Well, thank you so much, Richard Atwood. It's been absolutely riveting 1 hour. It seems like 5 minutes ago we started, actually. And I'm going to put you on the spot now. I'm going to say, will you please come back towards the end of the year? Because I think that we haven't touched on David Piper, all those wonderful races. We haven't talked about Steve McQueen at Le Mans. There's so much we haven't talked about.
Yeah, it was. I had a relatively short career, but it was compressed, and we did all the races we could. Some of those races at Kyalami that I did with David was Kyalami, another fabulous track, destroyed.
But the thing is also, there was so much variety. That's the thing,
yeah,
and that, which is gone now.
Mm.
And that's...
You're right.
Brian says the same thing. He said, in so many ways, we were so lucky.
The era was great, but hugely dangerous.
Yeah, sure. Actually, it's a sad but good point to end on, because we're broadcasting this in the week of the memorial service for Sid Watkins. Mm. I mean, as we speak, it's tomorrow, but probably be today. But let's not get into that, because anyway, it's this week. And of course, a man who did more than more than anybody to make racing as safe as it is today.
And Jackie Stewart.
Yeah. Thank you very much, everybody. And perhaps we'll all spend a minute or two tomorrow thinking about Sid Watkins, who did so much for the sport that we all love. And we'll see you next time on the Motorsport Magazine podcast. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.